Good afternoon. My name is Linda Smith Rhodes, and I am the editor of the New England Quarterly. Here with me are Stephen Whitfield, Max Richter Professor of American Civilization at Brandeis University, and Louis Menand, Ann T. and Robert M. Bass Professor of English at Harvard. Both Steve and Luke have written extensively on U.S. cultural history, and today they will be talking about J.D. Salinger and 1950s-era America. Their starting point will be Steve's ever-popular Cherished and Cursed, Toward a Social History of the Catcher in the Rye, from the archives of the New England Quarterly. Luke, one of NEQ's editors and himself an NEQ author, has kindly agreed to interview Steve. I invite you to listen in on their conversation.
Steve, so nice to see you.
Good seeing you.
This seems like a great occasion to talk about your article in New England Quarterly about Catcher in the Rye because of the recent death of J.D. Salinger. So I wondered if you had reactions to the press coverage and the general response to Salinger's death. Did anything surprise you about it or strike you about it?
I guess what was surprising in a way is that he was both a presence and an absence for so long. That is, the obituary notices would have been largely unchanged, I think, had he died in the mid to late 60s. The eerie, weird, odd thing, of course, about Salinger is the degree to which he had a second life, a life, of course, in Cornish, New Hampshire, that was completely independent of any of the trends that went on in the culture, so far as I can understand. And it's hard for me to imagine another career, at least in the mid-20th century, in the era of publicity and celebrity and book tours and book chats. It's hard for me to imagine a literary life, with the obvious exception, of course, of Thomas Pynchon, that will ever be like that. And yet Salinger, in a way, unlike Pynchon, is somebody who we feel we know as an author in some way. I know I'm now quoting from Holden Caulfield himself. But the sense, in other words, in which there's something about both the life and, in effect, the afterlife that is unsettling and a kind of displacement in which he could have died, except for the care and concern of his loved ones. In cultural terms, he could have died four centuries ago. And I just can't think, Luke, of any other literary career from the mid-20th century on that could remotely approximate that.
Yeah, it is unusual. I mean, you mentioned Pynchon, who does come to mind as one of these recluse authors, but Pynchon keeps publishing.
Yes.
And Salinger did not. Were you surprised that there was a little bit of a backlash by the time of his death over his sort of what felt like a rather willful hermitage that he undertook? That is, people felt that he was overplaying the part of the disaffected author. Or did it seem natural that most of the outpouring would be positive
yes.
about his
yeah.
writing?
I got that sense that the reaction was one of both gratitude for the legacy he left behind of those four books. I didn't sense myself any backlash that of resentment from those who expected him to be on talk shows all the time. I guess I was more struck by the degree to which there was an element of, if not reverence, at least a certain element of respect for the privacy that he maintained. And let's call it the dignity and the integrity of that. Now, there were certainly efforts to undermine that privacy through his daughter and through others who tried to, of course, run across him, efforts through his biographers. But by and large, the striking thing is it seems to me that the degree to which he was able to sustain that autonomous life immunized against all the things that would have been diverting and all the things that would have been enticing, that, it seems to me, is more likely from what I remember reading about in the obituary notices than what you were suggesting, maybe even a kind of resentment.
Yeah, I didn't feel a resentment either. I was a little surprised by the lack of it. Just, I would have felt from some quarters you would get mm-hmm. a little bit of a grudging response. But I think it is a testimony to the regard in which those books are held.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we'll talk about Catcher, but because that's mm-hmm. what your article was
yes.
about. But what about the other books, the stories and Fanny and Zooey?
Well, certainly, I think the nine stories from everything that I have read in terms of literary criticism and literary history are going to survive.
Yeah.
They are amazing achievements in terms of the delicacy, the tiny, tiny little calibrations that he's able to achieve. I don't have any sense of Franny and Zooey or of Ray Sigh the Roofbeams Carpenters and Seymour in Introduction having that kind of survival value. I think, you know, the standard literary term there would be precious, and they're a little bit too precious to survive in a more of a long, let it all hang out kind of culture that we now inhabit. But can I go back just one second with Pynchon? It seems to me that the curse that afflicted Salinger that suggests that there might have been a backlash is that anybody who cared about it knew where he lived, had a rough idea from the back cover of the first, what was it, the first three editions of The Catcher in the Rye, what J.D. Salinger looked like in 1951. And therefore, there was at least the possibility of the invasion of privacy. Pynchon, who I believe has not been photographed since, a high school yearbook,
yeah.
He was not photographed for his Cornell yearbook, has managed, in a sense, to elude any of the possibilities of resentment that you suggested, even as he's kept publishing. And that is both his elusive achievement in the sense that nobody bothers to demand of him what clearly, without quite the same degree of foresight, Salinger had to live through in terms of the demands placed upon him to please show up.
Yeah, it's interesting about Pynchon. I do think that in his case, there are people who could make it their business to find out where he is who don't. Mm-hmm. As I think actually the press has been rather careful about respecting his privacy.
Now, may I ask you what you think of the last two books?
Well, I'm of the school of narrow-minded people who feel that Franny is a great story ruined by Zooey. That is, I think Franny is a story in the same spirit of the nine stories, which I agree with your classic in the short story tradition, and hugely influential for other story writers after Salinger. And I think Franny is one of those stories. Zooey, I loved it when I was 15 or whenever I read it, but when I reread it, I did find it precious. I think Ray Sigh the Roofbeam Carpenters is a great story, and Seymour in Introduction is also rather precious and indulgent. So I'm one of those people who take the view that he was going a little bit off track in the last stuff that he did in his infatuation with the Glass family and with Seymour in particular. Mm-hmm. And somehow that seems mixed up with his desire to withdraw from the world. But I would say second to none in my admiration for the works that we've been talking about.
Yes. Look, I just wanted to pick up, if I may, on one point that you made in terms of when you read Salinger, which has to do with, in a sense, its enduring value. And that is he really a writer for teenagers whom adults or parents or teachers think should be read by teenagers? Or is there something else here in which he remains, as in the nine stories, has to be considered both an adult writer and a remarkable writer for sensitive kids?
I think Salinger is a writer's writer. So I think that he represents for a lot of people, certainly a lot of writers I know, that is non-academics who are professional writers, mm-hmm. a certain kind of ideal of craft. And I think that, you know, that's an adult thing. I don't think kids too much worry about the craft of Perfect Day for Banana Fish. They're just trying to figure out what the hell's going on in that story. But it's a remarkable piece of craftsmanship. And I think the craft, the voice that he's able to create in Catcher and so forth is something that will always probably be admired by writers. I was actually going to ask you this question, which is interesting, that it's interesting that the lost weekend of a prep school dropout whose parents live on Fifth Avenue seems to have close to universal appeal to people who didn't go to prep school and whose parents don't live on Fifth Avenue, and that is a kind of odd thing. So one answer your question suggests is that The Catcher in the Rye is one of these cases of the rich get richer. That is, having once established itself as the book that teenagers read, it is now given to teenagers as a book that they read, and therefore it gets read by teenagers. When they grow up, they give it to their teenage children to read because they were given it by their parents to read when they were teenagers. And that it has a kind of self-perpetuating quality to it within the culture. I'm not sure if that explains everything about it, but it certainly, it has the status of a book that you want your teenager to read. Why we want our teenagers to read it isn't entirely clear, because we certainly don't want them to drop out of school, solicit a prostitute, get drunk, use the word goddamn in every other sentence, and so forth. But my thought about it is that it has something to do with wanting your kids to know that they're still a kid in you. That is, that somehow you're telling them it's okay to be this way because, you know, I was like this too when I was your age. So it has a little bit of a handing on a generational thing to it.
But it seems to me the problem is to give it to a teenager doesn't mean that he or she's going to read it.
Yeah.
There's still the artistic mystery, or maybe the psychic mystery, that this is one of those books, like all sorts of movies, that don't have to be sold or even pre-sold. That still, as you were suggesting a few minutes ago, that may relate to the author's exceptional craft and exceptional capacity to provide a voice that is indelible. So it's still ultimately, it seems to me, about art and not about hands-off from one generation to the next. And the other striking thing, of course, that's also the Disney phenomenon, obviously, with younger children. And yet we outgrow Disney in all sorts of ways. But we don't seem to outgrow Salinger.
Yeah, it still seems to be chugging along. Another way to think about it is that the book gets constantly rewritten. So The Bell Jar was a rewriting, written version of it. I think Bright Lights, Big City was a kind of rewriting of it. I think Heartbreaking Worker, Staggering Genius was a kind of rewriting of it. So that every generation has its own version of the alienated adolescent who speaks in this wonderful voice that other adolescents respond to. And it attracts really talented writers like Eggers and Blath and McInerney. So that somehow Salinger's always at the back of all these stories. They're all trying to do that story over again. And that is part of what gives it its momentum, possibly.
Is it also an antecedent in Fitzgerald's This Side of Paradise? I mean, how far back would you go pre-Salinger to the voice of disaffected youth
that has some kind of resentment against the adult world? You might have put this way in your article. It all goes back to a book by Mr. Mark Twain called The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn.
But those parents didn't get it.
No, they didn't.
That's the difference.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's probably the emergence of a youth culture.
Youth culture.
Didn't exist in the late
19th century. It's a post-war thing. Yeah. As you know, teenager was really a 40s word. So youth culture needed products. I mean, to put that cynically, but there was an audience there which had built into it an idea of a state of being called youth, young person, teenager, and it spoke directly to that. One thing you say in your article is, I think I'm quoting, The Catcher in the Rye is utterly apolitical. And you're responding, when you say that, you're responding to efforts to appropriate it to kind of new left or counterculture, 60s radicalism. And you give some examples of people like Tom Hayden who cite Catcher in the Rye. It's kind of an influence. Although you cite also 60s writers who don't mention Catcher in the Rye. Mm-hmm. But certainly there was a sense that Holden Caulfield was a kind of premonitory version of the student radical or the dropout or the countercultural type of the 60s, and you are quite dismissive of that. So I want to ask you two questions about that. One is that one thing that was striking to me about the obituaries and the general response to Salinger's death was that everybody seemed to pay a lot of attention to the degree to which he was a 40s person. Do you want to talk a little bit about the way the 40s shaped the sensibility of The Catcher in the Rye?
Yeah, it's a tough one, Luke, because you're also asking me to talk about the 60s.
Yeah.
Within the same framework. Let me try to pick up the 60s part of it and why I believe the remark that you quoted is defensible. And that is, it seems to me, politics is ultimately about mobilization and enlistment of others. It's hard to imagine a politics that is solitary and that is fundamentally subjective. And as long as that definition is at least credible, then it seems to me everything in the psychic and emotional thrust of The Catcher in the Rye is against politics and toward the cultivation of the interior life. And the fact that the narrator imagines, for example, wanting to be a deaf mute so that nobody will talk to him or he doesn't have to talk to anybody, that is the opposite of the conversation we're having, suggests to me that that's an utterly apolitical book. The only element, and of course the other feature about the 60s, is that the counterculture was apolitical to a certain extent in the extension of the Beats, the hippies, into the hippies that were believing that basically no political solution was available. But the element where it is perhaps overstated in terms of the apolitical quality, and I don't know if this is what you were perhaps referring to, is that the 40s also produces the bomb. And the 40s produces something that was utterly unprecedented. So that when Holden Caulfield imagines that if there's another war, that he will sit astride the atomic bomb when it goes down, just the way Major King Kong
right.
goes down at the end of Dr. Strangelove, 1964,
yeah.
Is a kind of eerie premonition now of something that could at least be a hostility to a world in which politics doesn't provide any of the conventional solutions, because atomic warfare is utterly insoluble, and even deterrence has its extraordinary fears and anxieties. To that extent, in the sense that the 40s gave us an atomic age that nobody, no child, no teenager, no parent had ever lived through before, might allow for at least a certain kind of political edge. Or maybe, I would prefer maybe to call it an historical edge rather than a political one. But of course, the striking thing in that sense between the conventional 50s and the conventional 60s is the conventional 50s has no way of imagining concert with others. And the 60s is all about we must march, my darlings.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why it seems to me the effort to incorporate The Catcher in the Rye for all of its disaffection seems to me doomed.
And would you put On the Road in the same category?
Yes.
For the same reasons?
Yes.
Yeah.
Even though it's male camaraderie, and even though they're not particularly introspective and they're not particularly wanting to be by themselves, but it's a social world. It's not a world that imagines doing anything in any direction toward change or any alteration of the public realm.
Yeah, so you couldn't really extract a politics out of a book like that.
I don't think so, yeah. And again, the striking thing, if I can just elaborate on the point you made about the 40s, the other amazing thing is that J.D. Salinger is a product of some of the worst fighting in Europe, from Utah Beach, five hours after the first landing, all the way through the Battle of the Bulge. Somebody who knew war intimately. And yet, even though there are the traumatic and psychic scars of war, there is no larger sense of maybe we want to imagine a world in which the dangers of war are in any way reduced. Maybe I've come out of this experience wanting to do something. I mean, no American Veterans Committee, no civil rights legislation, no double V for victory. Now we've got to do something about achieving democracy at home. It seems to me there's none of that. And that's kind of in the solipsism of Salinger's art is a remarkable, call it purity.
Yeah.
Call it apolitical purity, maybe.
Yeah. No, he wanted to be a writer. Yeah, one feels that. Yeah.
But there are different kinds of writers. And you have to wait till the Tom Haydens emerged, not that he's a writer as such.
Joseph Heller, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Although Heller also has a kind of 50s repudiation at the end.
Yeah, but it's the anti-war book,
yes.
I would say.
Yes.
Yeah. Let's talk more generally about the Cold War period, because you're the author of one of the seminal studies of Cold War culture, and that was back in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes. Yeah, and the second edition was 96 of your mm-hmm. book. So looking back on the last 14 or 15 years, do you see changes in the scholarship of the Cold War period that might change the way you would have approached your subject when you were writing about it back in the early 90s?
Yeah, if we confine the subject to, let's say, the impact of geopolitics on American domestic life, culture, civil liberties, and so on, as opposed to the way in which the Soviet archives have been opened, so that we now see something more about, for example, how dangerous the world actually was during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Or if we see, now we know exactly how difficult it was for Kim Il-sung to get Stalin to agree to invade South Korea. If we're not talking about that, I will sound horrifically dogmatic and stubborn, but I don't see any major difference. The problem still remains that we did something to ourselves that we didn't need to do in terms of the violation of democratic norms. We did something to ourselves we didn't need to do in terms of politicizing areas of culture, Salinger being the most striking exception, perhaps. We politicized things that didn't need to be politicized in terms of the arts, to say nothing about the damages to people's careers. And I don't think that there has been any particular scholarship or any particular new research that has altered the general sense of something that needs to be revised. The only area that I can think of in which we seem to know more than when I was working on the culture of the Cold War is we now know how extraordinarily effective the FBI was in infiltrating the Communist Party. So that by the rampage of Joe McCarthy beginning February 1950, the Communist Party had already basically been, if not destroyed, it had been so enfeebled that the notion that the Communists might be capable of committing espionage within the American government or might have been engaged in something that was seriously a threat to national security, that had already vanished. So McCarthyism looks even less plausible. It was never justified, but it was certainly, you could make a case because of figures like Alger Hiss. Now it seems to me that case has evaporated.
Yeah, and you do, but you do sound that theme in your book already, that there was an exaggerated fear that the FBI was remarkably effective in infiltrating these organizations. You have to do a balancing act because you're on the one hand, you're yourself quite hard on communism, as we used to say. So it's not as though you think that there was something about communism that most American liberals were getting wrong.
Right.
At the same time, you feel that the internal threat was absurdly exaggerated, and that it did lead to, as we say, imitating our enemy in the way we approach culture. One thing that has been written about quite a bit, and it wouldn't change your thesis at all, you're quite right, I think, has been the subject of some recent books, is the role that the CIA played in both the export of American culture and also the covert subvention of American cultural enterprises domestically, which, of course, is contrary to the CIA's charter.
Yes.
Is there anything in that scholarship that strikes you as fresh or changing the picture at all?
Broadly speaking, I would say no. I think it's an open question, and on this point, I'm not sure my mind is thoroughly made up, that in the early 1950s, when we know that the cultural Cold War in Europe, in Asia, in Latin America in particular, entailed one side having tremendous government resources and the other side, namely us, having relatively few, in which the proverbial battle for hearts and minds looked a little bit one-sided, when we don't know the result, we don't know the ending, it seems to me that there's a moderate case to be made for government support. I don't think my mind would be in that my mind would be altered in the sense that that's still inherently bad for culture. It's ultimately, of course, bad for government. But in that area, I would say there's at least a little bit of wiggle room for a judgment call in the early 1950s, when it looked as though there might be the danger of a genuine explosion over Berlin, there might be a genuine kind of conflict, and before the full resources of American soft power seemed to be fully engaged in the effectiveness that they did engage in. it seems to me there's an element in which one might make a different judgment than simply this was a terrible idea.
Yeah, I mean, for what it's worth, yes. I think I agree generally with that view. That is, I think two things about it. One is that it seems to be documented and true that the CIA was engaged in covert enterprises to prop up and support.
Oh, yes, that's their Guatemala and Iran.
Right,
sure.
But also culturally, that is Encounter Magazine or yes. Partisan Review or places like things like that. But it also seems to be the case that the editors of those magazines and the directors of the Museum of Modern Art and so forth were also on the same page. In other words, right, they were all anti-communists in pretty much the same spirit.
Yes.
So it's not, the covertness had more to do with having to do an end run around Congress probably than with trying to undermine anybody else's wishes. And I also think better Jackson Pollock than guns.
If that's a choice.
Yeah. But it does run into the contradiction that you write about in your book, which is that if the purpose of cultural propaganda is to advertise a country in which the state is not involved with the arts, then you have a blatant contradiction facing you.
Yes.
So it does get very complicated.
Yes. I also should say for the record on this podcast that the political interventions, the coups that took place in Guatemala and Iran, were utterly disastrous.
Yeah.
There it seems to me there's no real ground for serious disagreement. The consequences were catastrophic.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. I'm thinking of the element of Cold War.
Yes, of culture.
History having to do with culture and how it was supported and how it was promoted.
Yeah.
So what are you working on now?
Well, I wanted to ask you this, actually, because what I'm really interested in cannot figure out a way of resolving the problem, and I'm very eager to your elucidation, has to do with how the 50s became the 60s. At the end of the 50s, nobody imagined how tumultuous a decade that would be. Nobody imagined the extent of the alienation, of which Holden Caulfield was a very modest instance when that book was published in 51. And I don't have an answer. I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on the subject, because not only was it not imaginable, but it's difficult to find buried in the 50s, beyond a few small instances, what would erupt in the 60s. So I want to turn the question over to you.
Yeah, well, if I could answer that question, we would sell out the podcast. Well, it's one of the great mysteries of post-war history, I think, trying to generalize that. Partly has to do with... we are free of this, thank goodness, but stereotyped views of both the 50s and the 60s, which tend to get in the way of figuring out what the transitions and continuities are, partly has to do with, I think still, people of our generation are a little over-invested in those stereotypes somewhat, defensive of their particular view of the 60s. I think that can all get in the way. But putting that aside, It is a difficult problem to solve. I tend to think that two things, which don't go all the way to explaining very much, but one is that the 50s was really an anomaly in American life in a lot of respects. That is, if you compare the 50s to the 40s or the 30s in terms of gender politics, in terms of demographics, in terms of the ways in which academic disciplines conceived of themselves and so forth, the 50s are quite unusual. So there's a tendency among conservatives conservative intellectuals in American life to imagine that the 50s are sort of the norm. I tend to think that's simply not true. The 60s were a lot like the 30s. They really weren't at all like the 50s, but the 50s were quite different from the way American social history had been before that. So to that extent, one could think of the 60s as a kind of release of a lot of energies that have been channeled into directions that were kind of at odds with the normal dynamics of American society. That's a little Hegelian and probably a little metaphysical. A more materialistic account perhaps would have to do something with the rise of the information economy and the enormous expansion of American higher education after the National Defense Education Act, the baby boom, and that created a class of people, academics and college students, who were much larger than that class of people had been before in American life. They were confronted with an event which basically broke the mold of all of containment doctrine thinking, Cold War thinking, anti-communist thinking, and American policy thinking, which was Vietnam. And that whole mindset of the Cold War period broke its head on that problem. It really split liberalism in two. It exposed the complicity of American institutions of higher learning with national policy, national security, with the Defense Department. And it did produce a kind of sense that you could constantly keep peeling away the layers of American life, and you could find underneath it this horrible sense of complicity in some kind of operation that was unstoppable. And we both lived through that period, and it really was as though every day, everything one confronted somehow had something to do with the question of Vietnam and what we were doing there. So that always seemed to me to have more to do with it than anything else. But that there were certain classes of people in place because of the expansion of higher education, because of the general raising of living standards in the United States in the 50s and early 60s, that gave them a particular perspective on American foreign policy that wouldn't have been possible in the 40s, might have something to do with why Vietnam was the explosive issue that it was.
Would that explain then why, when Vietnam basically comes to an end as an issue in American politics, as the war comes to an end, why the 60s doesn't continue?
Yeah.
In other words, if the 60s, you're saying, is actually closer to the norm, one would expect the 60s to continue.
Yeah. Well, I think the 60s...
It's effectively challenged politically.
The 60s continue in the sense that we are still highly conflicted society politically. That is, the culture wars are a way of continuing the 60s, I think. I do agree, though, that really what ended the 60s was the end of the draft, really, in 1970. And that somehow just seemed to unhook, to pull the plug out of a lot of the youth ferment that had characterized the 60s before that, and a lot of the anti-war sentiment. So the war wasn't over until 75, but really it had sort of faded from the domestic scene before that. I have one more question, if we have time. What do you think of the New England Quarterly?
Wonderful journal. Uh-huh. Since 1928. And what I like about it has to do with both the elegance of the journal itself. That is, the typeset. It has an element of both seriousness and readability. And even though there are many articles in there that are beyond my competence to judge, there are many articles in there that do not address issues that I happen to be concerned with, especially the further back you go into the American past. They're highly readable, they're well edited, they're literate. Generally speaking, free of the jargon that disfigures so much of scholarship.
Great.
I'm very pleased to be associated with it.
Me too.
Good.
Okay. Thank you.
For more information about this article, the New England Quarterly, or any of our publications, please visit our website at mitpressjournals.org.